For regular listeners to Matt's Musings, you will have noticed that this week's intro and also outro music is different. This can be credited to the creative and collaborative work of three of my current school's students, who very kindly spent some of their time during quarantine composing these pieces of music for the podcast. So before we get into the body of today's podcast, I'm going to play a little clip from two of those three students, just explaining a little bit about their creative compositional process.
So at the beginning, Adriano and I wanted to do a sort of Beatles-esque intro, or we wanted it to have a Beatles-esque feel to it. So I wrote a bass line based on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and I sent that to Adriano and asked him to improvise something on the guitar. And then he sent it back. But then I realized it didn't sound podcasty. It very much sounded like a BBC breaking news sort of segment. So what I did was I erased my bass line and I took the first two bars of Adriano's improvisation and I turned those into the new bass line for the finished version of it. And then I just improvised on top of his improvisation, but it still felt empty. So that's when I wrote Jimena and asked her to voice the line, but I gave her no direction.
Yeah, that was actually interesting. I didn't know what I was doing or what you were doing, rather, because you hadn't explained exactly what type of music you were going to make. So when he told me that that he wanted me to record the phrase, Matt's Musings, I had to try different things out, right? Because I didn't know exactly what would fit the music in the end. I hadn't heard it before. I didn't have any context except the podcast, of course. So I just spent a few minutes recording the title in different ways, in different tones, different speeds, and just playing around with it. But when I heard it after it was done, I was really impressed also, because it's very different from what Sebastian usually composes. So I just really liked it.
Welcome to episode 8 of Matt's Musings. And this week, we'll be discussing the topic of politics, populism, and elections. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at musings_Matt or via email at mattsmusingspodcast@gmail.com. You can also find me under the handle Matt's Musings Podcast on Instagram. On those social media channels, you'll find the link to the Acast page where you can access all of the podcasts, including today's and the previous 7 episodes. Matt's Musings is a cultural, historical, literary and political podcast for curious listeners and critical thinkers. This week's episode follows on from last week's episode on gaming. I'm going to begin this week's episode with a working definition of the term populism, which can be defined as a political approach or a mood or a set of attitudes or a style that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups. Please bear in mind the connotations and associations of the contrasting terms ordinary and elite from the working definition that I've just shared with you. To foreground today's discussion, I'm going to begin with a chronological potted history of the notion of populism. So throughout history, movements based on anti-elitism have repeatedly sprung up on both the left and right, often characterized by charismatic firebrands who harnessed the resentment of marginalised people. The first unmistakably populist movement in history appeared well over two centuries ago during the later stages of the French Revolution, and it was led by Robespierre and the Jacobins, who promised a reign of virtue. They were inspired by Rousseau, who believed that mere individuals should be subject to the general will of the social whole and, if necessary, forced to be free. As the revolution gathered pace and foreign armies mustered on France's frontiers, the Jacobins launched the first organised, state-led and ideologically legitimised terror in history. Chillingly, Robespierre declared, "The people is sublime, but individuals are weak." That is the cry of populists through the ages. Appropriately, the terror, 1793 to 94, ended with Robespierre lying on a plank, screaming with pain before he was executed by guillotine. Now, after the French Revolution, into the 19th century, we can say that Napoleon Bonaparte I is perhaps the first populist leader to emerge. He's succeeded later in the 19th century, 1848 to 1870 precisely, by Louis Bonaparte, who becomes Emperor Napoleon III. Turning our attention now to the end of the 19th century and in America, the People's Party, a populist party, felt squeezed by the unfettered capitalism of the Gilded Age, campaigned for workers' rights, female enfranchisement, nationalism, and financial support. The farmers, whose grievances inspired the People's Party, wanted cheaper credit and transport to carry their products to markets in the eastern states. Hence the party's two proposals. One was the nationalisation of the railways to cheapen transport costs. The other was free silver, the use of silver as well as gold as currency, supposedly to cheapen credit. Even then, this was not a particularly radical programme. It was designed to reform capitalism, not to replace it, as the largely Marxist social democratic parties of Europe were seeking to do. Moving back now to France and into the 20th century, the Front National appeals to a mythologised past symbolised by the figure of Joan of Arc. Joan was a simple, illiterate peasant from an obscure village in northeastern France who led the king's forces to a decisive victory over the English in the later stages of the Hundred Years' War. Moving through the 20th century, the Wall Street crash precedes FDR's New Deal, predicated on the Populist Party's values. In the depth of the Depression, Huey Pierce Long Jr.'s Share Our Wealth plan called for the federal government to confiscate the fortunes of anyone with more than $8 million in wealth to provide a $5,000 annual income and healthcare for all American families. Into the 50s, the decade of the McCarthyism and Red Scare, against subversion by communists, academics and artists, precedes the start of the Cold War, which in the history of populism is a pivotal moment because in the second half of the 20th century, populist shifts to the right. This is epitomised by segregationist Alabama governor George Wallace, who played the working class hero, snarling at pointy-headed bureaucrats and liberals. His third-party presidential bid in 1968 drew 13.6% of the vote, and his legacy is that conservatism has had a strain of anti-elitist populism ever since, most recently and effectively in the Tea Party. Recent British modern populists include Margaret Thatcher, who quoted about the enemy within, Nigel Farage, former leader of the UK Independence Party, and David Owen, now a Lord, but formerly a Labour Party member and a Social Democrat. To finalise the potted history, 2008 and the financial crash represents a pivotal moment in this history and precedes the emergence in contemporary terms of a number of populist global leaders, including Vladimir Putin, who tries to harness memories of a Tsarist glory, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who, in response to 2016 failed coup d'etat, has conducted expulsions, implemented sweeping new presidential powers, and also authorised mass arrests and detentions. President Trump's nativism in the States, Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism, the Brexit referendum in 2016, and the final piece in our metaphorical chessboard of populist players is the Brazilian Jair Bolsonaro, elected in 2019 and currently Brazil's president. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this week's special guest, who is not only the embodiment of the battling philosophy, a top raver, but also loyal, honest, and passionate in everything that he does, football, friendship, and most pertinently, in his job in politics. Welcome to Matt's Musings, Simon Lefebvre.
Thanks, Matt. What an introduction that was. The embodiment of battling philosophy is probably the highest honour that anyone could. And it's still on me, so thank you for including that as part of the introduction.
Ah, well, it's absolutely essential to your character and your philosophy, and something that you've imparted on me for sure.
Absolutely.
So, in the course of the next 50 minutes or so, Simon and I are hoping to discuss populism through a number of different subcategories: labour, anti-other hostility, corruption, globalism, education, the profile of a strong leader, rhetoric, and perhaps a comment on citizens' assemblies and the people's voice. So, Simon, why don't we begin with a quick discussion on anything from the potted history that really resonated with you or has a relevance to your current role?
Yeah, I think in terms of the things that I took out from it, and obviously sort of listening to what you've just said, particularly I think that in the modern context, it's very seen as a right-wing phenomenon, populism. And I think typically in Western society particularly, we use populism to refer to right people on the right, such as Trump or Johnson in the UK and Farage, etc., potentially. Uh-huh. And obviously, as you allude to, Thatcher as well. But actually, when you look at the origins, that actually it comes from, particularly the origin of the word populism from the People's Party, it comes from actually the left, and how that's changed over time, I think, is really, really interesting, because I think that as someone who is on the left working for a Labour MP, uh-huh, I think it's really important for us not to just see this as something which is purely something that affects the right. And if we're going to talk about populism and its ills, then we have to acknowledge the fact that it can also be something that affects the left as well, as we go forward. So I think that's sort of what I took from that, really, and something that I find interesting.
Brilliant. And I maybe got a little bit of ahead of myself. I want to just give you a brief opportunity to give the listeners an insight into your personal and professional background and how that's relevant to this week's topic of politics, populism and elections.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I consider myself to come from a fairly modest working class background. Obviously, went to uni where we met. I studied law and then did my master's in British politics. After that, I sort of went on to work in the 2015 general election, 2017 county council elections in Warwickshire, then the 2017 general election for the Labour Party. I then spent 2 years working for a sort of mental health charity, and then now I work for a Labour MP in one of the most deprived constituencies in the UK. And so I think that what's sort of given me is insight into different worlds and the various levels of inequality in society. And I think that what's really important for me about populism is that it disproportionately impacts and affects and is actually rooted in working class communities and disaffected communities. And I think I see that quite a lot in both my personal and professional life about how populism can take hold. And so I guess I have a vested interest in sort of examining that, exploring that, but also finding ways in which we tackle both populism itself, but also the underlying conditions which causes populism, which obviously we're going to explore it in a little bit of detail as we go through the podcast.
Absolutely. Well, just one further follow-up question on your background. You talked about your experiences in different contexts of local politics, but what's the sort of intersectionality or the crossover concerning, as you said, sort of neglected communities and mental health issues? How do they manifest themselves in the sorts of areas where you've worked?
Yeah, so I think it's massive, and particularly I think that in the fact that a lot of them go undiagnosed, particularly in working class or deprived communities, because this idea that, you know, there's almost a bravado that still exists in certain deprived communities where it's not okay to talk about these things, and in society where we have been working to, of course, really hard to, and rightly so, to reduce the stigma that's attached to mental health, potentially those changes are a little bit slower to form in working class communities, which means that, you know, we do have a lot of undiagnosed mental health issues which then build up and they're not treated as soon as they could be, which then develop into greater issues further down the line. So I think that's the biggest thing potentially that I've noticed. I guess that's what I'd sort of say is the biggest thing that I've noticed.
Brilliant. Well, shall we begin with a first textual connection, and we can use that as a starting point to consolidate what we've learned from both the definition and the potted history. Do you want to begin with your extract from the first article we have?
Yeah, okay, so the first article that we have is an Atlantic, it's an article from The Atlantic, which is entitled, What is Populism? And the quote sort of speaks to one of the things that you spoke about in the potted history, which is the People's Party, and this is where the sort of term really originates from. And the quote reads, the term dates back to the late 19th century, and the arrival of the populist People's Party in the United States. American farmers had grown frustrated with their lack of prosperity in the economic boom of the Gilded Age, an exclusion they attributed to government corruption and the outside influence of big business. In the People's Party, or the Populist Party, as it was widely known, they found an outlet for those frustrations. The party, which positioned itself as an alternative to the Republicans and Democrats, campaigned on a series of what were at the time radical policies, including increased economic regulation, nationalised railroads, and directly elected senators. Like many modern populists, the party also showed antipathy towards immigrants, blaming their presence on the manufacturers and their desire for cheap labour. So I think this is sort of the first quote. And the reason that I sort of wanted to speak about this, because I think it really offers a framing of where populism first came from, and the term, although as you pointed out in the part of history, there are definitely people before this who have been considered populist in what we now consider to be populism.
Uh-huh.
But this is the origin of that phrase. And I think it's really interesting to see both the similarities between that and modern populism, and also the differences between the populism of then and today. And I think that the common themes we see then, for instance, in that quote, you know, with the American farmers growing frustration with their lack of prosperity in the economic boom of the Gilded Age, that's definitely something that I feel is a really a core fundamental part of populism, is the conditions with which populism is allowed to thrive and allowed to take root. And I think the idea of economic prosperity and the feeling of communities being left behind when everything around them is potentially improving is certainly something that allows populism to take root. And I think that the system, whether it be political parties or the education system, etc., not dealing with these issues at the root is certainly something that we see then and something we see now, for example, with the rise of UKIP, potentially in the UK, which they grew a lot of their strength out of the 2008 financial crash and the consequences of that, and they like, sort of took root in communities that were disproportionately affected by the economic crash, for instance. Yes. I think they, you know, attributing the prosperity to corrupt force. So, you know, back then, with the People's Party, it was government corruption, the outside influence of big business. I think that, again, look towards the modern populists, and they always, that's a really common theme as well, this corrupt system, whether it be, again, the government, or whether it's, you know, the elite, which is obviously a common theme that runs through populism. There's always an aspect of that that runs through populists from today. And now, I think what's really interesting about then is they sort of position themselves as the alternative to the Republicans, Democrats, as populists do. They got on a claim that they are outside the system. And then finally, I guess with that quote, is that even the idea of globalisation, which wasn't anywhere near what it is then, today, you can still see the sort of the influence of globalisation in the foundation of the People's Party and the term populism, you know, particularly towards, you know, the big business and the blame of the presence of immigrants on the manufacturers and the desire for cheap labour. That obviously those themes now run into communities that feel they have been disproportionately impacted by immigration in the current climate, which are where the conditions where populism thrives. So I think that seeing that how it started and how it's progressed, I think is a really interesting framing for what populism is in the modern context and where it stems from. And in particular, sort of following from that is, you know, who is going to be a populist leader and what makes a populist leader? And there's another quote from that same article further on, which sort of says, Catherine Fishi, the author of Populocracy, The Tyranny of Authenticity and the Rise of Populism, put forward her own list of characteristics to identify populist leaders, namely those who not only claim to represent the will of the morally superior ordinary people, but also position themselves as uniquely capable of doing so. As a result, Fishi argues, populists reduce their political opponents, whom they often accuse of being part of the elite, to enemy status. Now, this sort of brings in a few of the themes that obviously you touched upon at the start, you know,
yeah,
particularly the idea of ordinary people versus the elite, which is a really common thing amongst populism. And I think that you can really see that in a modern context. You can see it played out in real life as well, rather than just the theory. So very quickly, I mean, look at President Trump in America, I think embodies the idea of that populist leader that Fishi was talking about there.
Uh-huh.
You know, talks about improving the lives of ordinary Americans, how he's going to make America great again. And he harks back to the great age where American industry was dominant, etc. You know, he is a one-man band. He's the centre of everything that he does. His rallies are very Trump-focused. His whole campaign is based around him as a leader. And interestingly, I think he positions himself as outside the system. You know,
yeah.
Although he's a property real estate tycoon, uh-huh, amongst many other things, he almost used that to his advantage by saying, "I don't have to get business investment in my campaigns to get elected because I've already got the money. I'm not going to be, I'm not part of the political establishment. I don't have the same vested interests as them, even though, of course, he has his own vested interests."
Yes.
And, you know, the talk about the establishment as the enemy, draining the swamp, you know, the fake news and the mainstream media, the way he talks about those, crooked, yeah, Hillary. It just, for me, you can really see that idea of the populist leader being played out in a real-life context with Trump.
Yeah, and that's so interesting, because if we go back to the fundamentals, they are economic causes, and perhaps that then, in a globalised world context, has as a secondary consideration the presence of different workers who may be from a different nation, thus immigrants. And in the embodiment of Trump as a populist leader, I just wanted to ask you, before we consider a fictional and very prophetic, accurately predicted portrayal of a populist leader, I just wanted to ask you what role you thought that the sort of jingoistic, confrontational, conflict rhetoric and language that populist leaders such as Trump use, why is that so effective in the sort of disaffected communities that you have described previous to this part of the discussion?
Yeah, so I think that the crux of it comes down to a couple of things. One, in that they actually speak a language which speaks to people and speaks about people's concerns, and they're not afraid to speak about things which potentially the rest of the political system is not talking about for one reason or another. So immigration is case in point, I think, with this, in that we have a political system which for a long time didn't discuss immigration and wasn't willing to challenge, you know, because what you can do by having a dialogue is challenge things that and preconceptions about a certain idea. So rather than shutting down debate around immigration, what we should have been focusing on was celebrating the benefits of it and really celebrating and proving to people what is the benefit of immigration, rather than just go, we're not talking about that because we're not allowed to. And what happens is that people have these fears and these concerns, and you've got one group that aren't speaking about it, and you get another person who comes along and he's really not afraid to rock the apple cart and use this sort of vitriolic language that you see Trump and the other leaders, you know, Farage, for instance, and it speaks to people's fears that haven't been allayed by the mainstream political system. And I think that there's an idea as well that sort of following on from that, that the system is so strong and that it's so embedded in society, and that what you need then to tackle that strong society and system is a strong leader who can stand up to that and make real change. Because if you're weak, you're not going to be able to change this political system that has been there for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Okay, so to follow up that section on strong, unconventional, brave, perhaps in terms of their linguistic choices, leaders, I'd just like to read one extract from Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, as I said, hugely prophetic, titled It Can't Happen Here. And some of the characters are talking about the merits of this strong leader. So one of the characters, called Crowley, says, "It might not be so bad. I don't like all these irresponsible attacks on our bankers all the time. Of course, Senator Windrip has to pretend publicly to bawl the banks out, but once he gets into power, he'll give the banks their proper influence in the administration and take our expert financial advice. Yes, why are you so afraid of the word fascism, Dormus? Just a word, just a word. And might not be so bad. With all the lazy bums we got panhandling relief nowadays and living on my income tax and yours, not so worse to have a real strong man like Hitler or Mussolini, like Napoleon or Bismarck in the good old days, and have them run the country and make it efficient and prosperous again. In other words, have a doctor who won't take any back chat, but really boss the patient and make him get well, whether he likes it or not." So what's your response to that metaphor of the populist leader sort of overlapping into some fascist proclivities, but being characterised as the no-nonsense doctor who ultimately cures the sick patients?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting sort of paragraph, a really interesting quote. And I think particularly from that, you sort of see how people are frustrated with the current system, and they're frustrated with how things are now, and that anything seems better than what they've got. And even things that we know, I mean, like, you know, Hitler or Mussolini, who were horrific leaders in history, what this is trying to say is that in the face of these things, actually, is that so bad? Because at least we'll be on the sort of put on the right path. And I think there's a couple of things in there which really sort of speak definitely to populism, you know, particularly the idea that lazy bums panhandling relief nowadays and living on my income tax and yours. And I think
yes,
definitely see those themes running through the idea of where we vilify the other, and whether it benefit cheats or whether it's immigrants coming in, and this whole narrative around immigrants being a drain on the economy, where we know that's not true. And you know, the other thing I found really interesting in that is the idea of pretend publicly to bawl the banks out.
Yes.
Once he gets into power, he'll give the banks the proper influence in the administration and take our expert financial advice. Because I think that's something which in modern day populism is really present, where what they purport to be is one thing. They purport to be on the side of the ordinary people and take on the establishment. But actually, in reality, what they often do in a modern context is actually reinforce the status quo. Or if not, they just replace it with a different form of sort of corrupt or undesirable government.
Yeah, okay. And that's why, I guess, when we talked about some of the subcategories that run parallel to this discussion, perhaps the importance in education and educating people to be able to decipher the difference between a smokescreen and something that is genuine, authentic policy is perhaps emerging as a recommendation that we might have to people.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about the ability to critically think and analyse certain topics and what people are saying, and not just what they're saying, the motivations behind what they're saying, you know, these are things which you're taught during your education. And if you deprive certain communities of that education, then you're going to deprive them of these skills to properly analyse whether it's the words, the meanings, the things that these people are saying and the policies that they have, and all you're really leaving to do is a feeling that they have. Uh-huh. And when the feeling that they have is that actually this person's speaking my language and he's talking about issues that no one else is, then that's all you've got for people to go on. And that's why we see, in my opinion, partly the growth of populist parties and these strongmen that we're discussing.
Okay, well, slightly more on the notion of the strongman, populist leader. This is a short extract taken from an Aeon article titled "Lawyer for the Strongman: Demagogues Do Not Rise on Popular Feeling Alone, but on the Constitutional Ideas of Weimar and Nazi Legal Theorist Carl Schmitt." David Dinsenhaus says, but there is in fact a robustly intellectual foundation for strongman politics. Populism is not just a bull in a china shop way of doing politics. There is a theoretical tradition that seeks to justify strongmen rule, an ideological school of demagoguery, one might call it, that is now more relevant than ever. Within this tradition, one thinker stands out, the conservative German constitutional lawyer and political theorist Carl Schmitt, living between 1888 and 1985. For a time, he was the principal legal advisor to the Nazi regime, and today his name is approaching a commonplace. Academics, policymakers, and journalists appeal to him in order to shed light on populist trends in the US and elsewhere. A recent article in the New York Review of Books argues that the US Attorney General William Barr is the Carl Schmitt of our time. The Oxford Handbook of Carl Schmitt, 2017, came out in print the year after Trump's election. After decades as a political rogue, forced to launch his attacks on liberalism from the sidelines, Schmitt's name has returned to prominence. So, Si, I know that you also have a legal background, so perhaps could you give me your insights into the crossover between a legal system and the political notion of populism?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, as I sort of briefly alluded to earlier, you know, that populism comes in and talks about rebelling against the system. And it talks about, you know, it creates this level of mistrust within the system, and, you know, by way of doing that, also mistrusting the processes of that system. So, you know, if you have a society that disbelieves in a government, it also is likely to disbelieve in the courts that government has. And because they believe so strongly in this central figure, strongman populist party, when there's a conflict between this leader and the courts, they're going to side with the leader. And the person who's speaking to them, because, you know, this again represents me, whereas the system doesn't represent me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a sort of real life example of that is in the UK. And to call Boris Johnson a populist leader is a debate in itself, but I think he certainly shows some populist tendencies.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, this is something that obviously we had to deal with at the time, was when in the UK, when Boris Johnson prorogued Parliament.
Yes.
for anyone who doesn't know, proroguing a parliament is where sort of parliament breaks for a short period of time. It's a regular thing to happen, but it's the length of time in this instance that was so controversial because Boris Johnson wanted to prorogue parliaments for 5 weeks. Now, the backdrop to this was that the withdrawal agreement was currently going through at the same time, and the withdrawal agreement was set to go during the middle of this period of proroguing, which denied parliament the ability to properly scrutinise the withdrawal bill. And Brexit is, you know, is largely seen as a populist endeavour and a populist campaign, you know, obviously led by UKIP and Farage, etc. And what happened was that this went through the court system in the UK and eventually reached the Supreme Court, who decided that Boris Johnson was illegally prorogued Parliament and they had to recall. So it was quite an embarrassing climb down for Boris Johnson. They had to recall Parliament.
Yes.
But what we saw from that, in the wake of that, was in the 2019 Conservative Manifesto, was the idea that the courts need to be changed and we need to review the relationship between Parliament and the courts. So rather than going, okay, the courts who hold the balance of powers and in every checks and balances in a government, you have to have them because you don't want authoritarian centralised control. What we're now seeing is when the courts went against Boris Johnson, it's the courts who are at fault because he's trying to enact the will of the people. And, you know, they used the emotive language in that debate, you know, around the surrender bill, for instance, and how it's a betrayal of the British people, which is just typical, you know, populist language.
Yeah.
And rather than it being the government who is in the wrong, it's now the courts. And so it's just eroding that faith in any sort of system and centralising power, you know, including the legal system.
Yes. And your comments there really resonated with me about populist leaders really seeking to avoid being embarrassed in any way. And you gave the example of Johnson proroguing Parliament. But as I said in the potted history, we see with Erdogan in Turkey, his response to the failed coup d'etat was to enforce mass distrust of institutions, some of them legal, some of them educational, some of them political, and to imprison, to subjugate, and to silence. So I think in historical terms, what was limited to a sort of North American and European geographical realm is now beginning to manifest itself in different continents of the world, namely further to the east in Turkey, and also, as we may discuss a little later, in Latin America.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what's really interesting about that is because the different way in which democratic systems were formed, you know, Western Europe and North America particularly, obviously share a lot of commonalities in the way that their democratic systems were formed.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting is when we see it pop up in different contexts, because we can then examine, again, the conditions as we've been speaking about, you know, what's the similarities, what the differences in how these things happened. And it sort of paints it as not just a Western Europe phenomenon necessarily, but how it's expanded to the rest of the world, as you say, particularly Turkey and Latin America.
Okay, well, let's move on, Si. Would you like to talk a little bit about Bolsonaro and Trump, or should we move through to more of a local focus? It's up to you.
I think that sort of particularly I wanted to look at the sort of the corruption aspect.
Go ahead, mate.
Because I think it ties into what we've been speaking about in terms of a mistrust in a system and this idea of a strong man who is uniquely placed. And I think it really ties in because what populists purport to do is they purport to want to change the system for the good of the people and to make, I'm going to fix the system, essentially, is what they're trying to say. But that's actually not borne out in reality. I think that's a really interesting thread of populism, to sort of explore that a little bit more. So again, going back to another Atlantic article that's titled What Populists Do to Democracies. Now this is an article that's based on leading peer-reviewed journals. They also consulted country and regional experts, and they came up with a list of 46 populist leaders, and what they then did was map this versus the democratic development or regression of those countries. And the article reads, to participate in politics in a meaningful way, A country must have freedom of the press so that citizens can make informed choices, protect civil liberties, so that citizens are free to voice their preferences and organise around their interests and maintain political rights, so that most adults have the right to participate in free and fair elections. On all of these counts, populist governments fall short. Controlling for the many ways in which countries that elect populists may be different from countries that do not, including per capita income, recent economic performance, a country's history with democratic institutions and civil conflict, we found that populist rule is associated with a 7% decline in freedom of the press, an 8% decline in civil liberties, and a 13% decline in political rights. Now, just in that very nature, what you expect to be empowering the people and empowering a country, well, actually seeing in reality what's borne out is that in populist countries, we're seeing that all these idea of liberty is actually being wound back and eroded. And that same article then goes on to describe how 23% of populist governments see a democratic backsliding, defines at least 1 point drop in a country's democracy score, compared with 6% of non-populist governments. There's a massive disparity there. You know, as we've sort of pointed to it, not just being a right-wing phenomenon, there's little difference, according to this report and the journals that they've read, between left and right-wing populism, and that these erosions happen no matter what the political siding of the government. And just sort of finally on the article, I found this particular quote really interesting. Well, far from draining the swamp, most populists have, as economist Barry Eichengreen put it, simply replaced the mainstream's alligators with even more deadly ones of their own. In fact, we found that 40% of populist heads of government are ultimately indicted for corruption. Since many populists amass sufficient power to hamper independent investigations into their conduct, it is likely that this figure actually underestimates the full extent of their malfeasance. This suspicion is corroborated by a second piece of information. Our data shows that populist governments have led their countries to drop by an average of 5 places on Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index. Some cases are far more extreme than that. Venezuela, for example, dropped an astounding 83 places under the leadership of Hugo Chavez. Now, what I sort of find really interesting about that is that we've sort of seen this idea, as I mentioned, of going to fix the system. But that quote that really stood out to me was replacing mainstream alligators with even more deadly ones of their own. And I think this sort of goes to the heart of this issue, is that they claim to want to fix the system, but in reality, all that happens is they're replacing one unfair, arguably corrupt system with another one that ultimately normally just benefits themselves and their own agenda. So you sort of see with Trump in America, where the relaxation of workers' rights and the rollback of the state necessarily, which benefits big business, which obviously he has a vested interest in.
Yeah.
I mean, Nigel Farage has always been a campaigner against the European Union. And, you know, his claim to want to sort of take back democracy and things like from the European Union, I think when you actually look at the UKIP's policies, are quite the opposite of that. So I just thought it was a really interesting thing about corruption, and far from fixing the system as they claim to, we can see that populist governments actually erode democracy and lead to increased corruption when they've got power.
Well, with those motifs in mind, why don't we push the conversation ahead to have a local focus, but sort of analyse that through the prisms of, as you've said, a continuation of the issue of corruption, but also of workers' rights and conditions, and, as we said before, of the notion of education. So why don't we just talk briefly about some of our shared experiences of communities that had former mining industries and are now into sort of second, third generation consequences of the termination of that industry?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, you know, when we talk about the conditions and you know, earlier, that's sort of why I wanted to discuss around the origins of populism and how it's developed, because to really understand the conditions of which populism is allowed to take root allows us to effectively examine, you know, how it's happened essentially, how we've got to here, and how we prevent it going on in the future. And I think that, you know, when we look at the parties, for instance, in the UK that UKIP's taken hold in, it is these sort of traditional working class communities where you know, the whole community was centered around, say, the pit, the mine. So you knew that when you grew up, you're going to go down the pit, you're going to work in the mine. That would be your job. It's not pretty. It's not brilliant work. But at the end of the day, you know it's there. It's secure. It's safe. You can provide for your family. And quite often as well, you know, it was the center of the community.
Yes.
So, you know, it'd be your working man's club that you'd go to after work, and that sense of togetherness that was built. And I think that what we've seen is almost with the loss of those industries, nothing's replaced it, and it's left this void.
Absolutely. And I think that's so interesting, because if we put that into a sort of mathematical equation, perhaps people are willing to sacrifice some working conditions, or were willing to, in order to guarantee security and community togetherness. Whereas, as you said, those positions have either not been replaced, or, as we know from some of the research that both of us have conducted, they've been replaced by jobs such as working in a call centre or in an Amazon warehouse. These are jobs that, as we've known from the last sort of 5 to 10 years of workers' rights headlines, are characterised by 0 hours contracts, which are the epitome of the opposite of security provided by the less desirable, perhaps, mining jobs that preceded them. So what's the relevance between populism then and the sort of 21st century industries, such as working in an Amazon warehouse, for example?
Yeah, so I think what it all stems down to is that, you know, we've talked about the idea of security, and I think it's two things really. It's one, it's the real tangible issue, so the economy, you know, the insecure working that we've just spoken about, and the problems that stem from that are, you don't know what, you know, next week how many hours are going to have. You haven't got a secure income, you know, particularly around the idea of childcare. You know, it is a massive issue, because if you don't know when you're working next week, how do you arrange childcare?
Totally.
I think also it comes down to workers' rights as well, as because obviously there's different sorts of workers' rights, isn't there? You know, as we sort of pointed out there, that the dangerous work of the mines where your life was more at risk. But in terms of workers' rights now with 0 hours contracts, if you raise an issue, then they're under no obligation to provide you with any more work. So if you're seen as a troublemaker, or you know, you try and you know, you want to force through your workers' rights, or you make them acknowledge those rights and stick to them.
Yeah.
Then you have very little power, because they can say, oh well, we don't need you next week, I'm afraid. So it reduces people's willingness to speak out.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of one side of it. And of course, you know, I think that when you look at the general economy, particularly, you know, housing is a massive one, and house prices, it's a really well-documented issue, is that there is a sense that before, it was dirty, it was hard work, but you earned enough, you could buy your own house, and you could leave that for your children to improve their lives.
Yeah.
What that's been replaced with is a sense of that it doesn't matter how hard I work, it doesn't matter what I do, we can't afford to get on the housing market, I'm going to have very little to leave behind for my children. And that idea of you can leave a better life for your children is disappearing. And so what it feeds into this feeling, and that's the second element of this, the tangible parts that we can point to, but there's also this feeling as well. There's a feeling that things aren't getting better. There's a feeling that I'm not going to leave a better life for my children than they had for me. And we're actually seeing that borne out in the stats now, in terms of, you know, young working class people's lives now are not better than their parents were.
No.
And I think that combined with the lack of community that we've spoken about, it just feels that things were better back then than they are now, and put that in the context of a political system that's telling you you've never had it so good. You know, we're better now than ever, but that's not the real reality, or at least the felt lived reality, if you will, of these communities.
Absolutely, and I think that rhetoric from governments about we are living, we've never had it better, as you said, is predicated on, I assume, some economic statistical data, and that's probably where we begun our conversation about populism, on economic fundamentals, so I guess that's not surprising. But what is surprising is just the huge gaping gap between a government or a politician's understanding of what economic data actually means to everybody. And I think Jacinda Ardern, the current leader in New Zealand, amongst others, has been talking for a few years about maybe we need to amend and adapt the conversation about what actually constitutes progress in a nation. Because for the past century or more, the main indicator of progress has been an economic marker, for example, GDP. And as you've said, for neglected communities who've lost the heart of their industry, but also their identity, you know, a nation's GDP is pretty irrelevant, especially when, as you say, they can't even guarantee their working week in the week that's coming and therefore can't organise childcare.
Absolutely. I think the other problem with that is that they also have a habit of picking and choosing the economic stats which they choose to use. So, you know, as you say, a lot of it's focused on GDP and general economic output. But, you know, for instance, relative poverty. So relative poverty sits at a higher level now than it did in the 1960s. And in fact, you know, it was during the 80s and the 70s, but during the 80s that we saw the real take-up of relative poverty with, you know, the liberalisation of the economic market. But that's not focused on. And if relative poverty is higher, that shows that the difference between the rich and the poor is growing, which can lead to more disenchantment within these communities. But it's not. They don't want to focus on that. And when we talk about progress, that's not really focused on. As you say, it's just pointing towards GDP and the general economic data that shows what our country's done. Yeah. And I think another point that you sort of touched on there was that this disconnect between what the politicians are saying and the people. And I think that's borne out because, you know, the fact is that the politicians are not representative of the communities which they serve anymore. Uh-huh. And I always take the point of view is that I can't change necessarily the Conservative Party, but I can look and examine the Labour Party's role in this.
Yeah.
And if you look in the 1960s, 40% of Labour politicians and MPs were from working class backgrounds,
uh-huh.
whereas today it stands at just 10%. So, you know, even as we've got to take an introspective look at this as a party and say, are we really representing these communities ourselves? And is part of that to this feeling that we're talking about, if we're not part of that community, can we really understand this feeling that's there? Because we can look at the data, but if there's something more to this and the reason that people are going to populist parties, then we have to understand that feeling that's there. And in order to do that, I would potentially argue that we need more representation of communities that we're discussing about and who feel that feeling.
And perhaps one way in which to increase the percentage or not just the percentage of politicians from working class backgrounds, but more generally the diversity and the accurate representation of communities in politics, maybe we need to begin with education. So why don't we just finish our sort of conversation on the British context with a brief comment on the role of education in disaffected communities and the rise of the populist leader?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, education is a massive part. I mean, you know, if you look at what determines how successful someone's going to be, education undoubtedly plays such a massive part in that. And I think that if we look at our education system at the moment, we're not giving everyone the same chance. So you can have two people who have exactly the same ability, but that if one comes from a working class background and one comes from a middle class family, the child from the middle class family will go sort of further ahead. And I think that a really interesting sort of insight into this is a book by a lady called Diane Ray, which is titled Miseducation, Inequality, Education and the Working Classes. And what this is, it's a study into working class children's education, particularly comparing the comprehensive education of both working class children and middle class children. She's from a working class background herself, went on to be a Cambridge professor, and sort of encountered a number of challenges in her own education, which led her to have a deep interest in this particular topic. And in that book, she says, there are predominantly middle class comprehensive and predominantly working class ethnically mixed comprehensive. And despite all the rhetoric around pupil premiums, pupils in the more working class comprehensive get less money per head They get less qualified teachers, they get higher levels of teacher turnover and more supply teachers. Even if they are in the same schools as middle class children, they are in lower sets, and yet again, they get less experienced teachers. A working class child starts the educational race halfway around the track behind the middle class child. And I think this is really powerful for a number of reasons, because there's a lot of focus in modern politics about private schools and around grammar schools. And, you know, that in itself is probably now a long podcast if we're going to
definitely
the finer details of the education system in that context. But I think even if we look at comprehensive schools, so take out the selective schools and the fee-paying schools, even in comprehensive schools, we've got a situation where, you know, middle-class children in comprehensive schools get a better education than working-class children in comprehensive schools. And again, it just feeds into this idea, and I always want to link it back to sort of populism, obviously being the topic, is that, again, so you've got the idea of the left behind economically, the communities have been left behind, and now we get a situation where they're also left behind educationally. It just adds this growing frustration in a system that doesn't seem to it just doesn't stand up for them and their interests. And so that, for me, leaves a void with which populism can fill.
Yeah, definitely. Really. I think, just to give my personal insight, having had two contrasting experiences in the education system, one in a state school in, as I said, a former mining community in Yorkshire, and now in the private, fee-paying, therefore exclusive, international education system, what resonates with me especially is that in Britain, classes were setted by ability, based on statistics. Here, at my present school, there is no setting. There is no form of educational hierarchy. And whilst it's difficult to compare those two educational systems because they have many, many differences, I would say, just as a professional observation, that in terms of integration and heterogeneity and diversity and representation, the sorts of motifs that we've been discussing, I am a proponent of mixed ability, non-setted year groups. I think it works well for cohesion, and ultimately, in educational progress terms, I think it's a good collaborative opportunity for the students who might be struggling with one topic to work with the students who are more confident in that topic. I would abolish sets if I had the power, I think.
Absolutely. I think this comes down to you know, the thing that was talked about in that quote there, where, you know, lower sets, what you tend to get is the naughty, you know, quote-unquote naughty kids going in those lower sets. And so what you have is you have that sort of feeding each other. And actually, when we look at the behaviour of children in school, quite often what we call naughty behaviour is just a lack of understanding of a topic. And because they're struggling to engage with the topic, is actually that is then manifesting itself in bad behaviour. Because rather than face up to reality in front of their peers that I can't do this because of the embarrassment factor that comes with that, it manifests itself in bad behaviour. Whereas in mixed sets, as you say, they can learn from their peers, that they can have that sort of peer learning, which I think is a really important aspect for both people who understand and people who don't understand, and you actually see, you know, the overall level of attainment for all children rise because of these mixed sets.
All right, well, I'd like to finish by reading a poem titled Bad New Government by a poet called Emily Berry, whose poem I think really encapsulates lots of the topics that we've been discussing. So, Berry's speaker says, "Love, I woke in an empty flat to a bad new government. It was cold, the fridge was empty, my heart, that junkie, was still chomping on the old fuel. Vroom, I start the day like a tired motorcyclist. I want to go very fast and email you about the following happy circumstances. Early rosebuds, a birthday party, a new cake recipe. But today it's hot water bottles, an austerity breakfast, and my toast burns in protest. You are not here, of course, but you live in me like a tiny valve of a man. You light up my chambers. Later, I will call to tell you about the new Prime Minister, the worrying new developments, and about how I am writing my first political poem, which is also, always, about my love for you. Were there any aspects of Berry's poem that particularly resonated with you, Si?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's this idea of a bad new government, but the fridge still being empty. I think that's something which very early on in the sort of poem sort of spoke to me, because it's this idea of that as the even though the government changes, the lived reality doesn't necessarily change. You know, the fridge is still empty, and it's still as things were before. And, you know, the other thing I think from that was the sort of the failure of society to act. You know, the idea of the toast burning in protest. You know, it sort of, to me, sort of speaks to potential apathy that runs through society. You know, we see this austerity with the need for hot water bottles, the disadvantage that's within the poem, and that the sort of process within that is that the toast's burning. And I think that, you know, that speaks to a society, as we say, linking it back to populism, in that number of governments who don't change things for people, and that society is not willing to act and change that, and so what comes in its place, and I see that as populism.
Let's move into one of the final features of today's Matt's Musings podcast, and I started the episode with a working definition of populism, which featured two contrasting terms, ordinary and elite. And I just want us to have a quick discussion about the etymology of these two contrasting terms and how that etymology, i.e. the historical evolution of the meaning, has relevance in a contemporary context. So to look at ordinary first, belonging to the usual course, and this is sort of 15th century French meanings, orderly regarding rank and status. So we'll bear that in mind for a second and contrast that with elite, coming again from French, but later in the 19th century, connoting selection or choice, but also selection by bishop. So there's a religious undertone. Why do you think the etymology of those contrasting terms have significance to populism in the 21st century, Si?
Well, I think it's that clear differentiation between the ordinary elite, as you just said there, so, you know, ordinary coming from the idea of rank and status, you know, which would itself be sort of a lower rank or status than others than the elite ruling group. Which I think is a common theme that sort of populism tries to play on, in that, you know, there's this elite and we are the ordinary, they have been almost subjugating us, we are a lower rank of them, it's time for us to rise up, if you will, and change our status. And I think if you look at elite, you know, the whole selection, the choice, the selective group, the few, you know, this is the interests of a few rather than the overall general population, and that's the themes that populism plays on ultimately.
Really interesting. Okay, and I would like now for us to move into the mystery sound effect feature of this week's podcast, and for returning listeners, I can reveal to you that the mystery sound effect from last week's episode on gaming was in fact the sound from the Pac-Man. If you guessed it correctly, very well done. Now, this week's gem, if I may say so myself, of a mystery sound effect is less a sound effect and more a quotation from a person. So as a listener, your task is to identify the person and the setting in which you would hear this sound effect. Here we go.
Order, 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 order.
Allah,
Who is it and where does he say it? Okay. Now, Simon, last thing from you, and the last part of today's episode is I have a couple of quick fire questions for you. So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, as I have done with all of my special guests. So,
okay.
Quick fire question number one. One tip or recommendation that you would have to a listener seeking to navigate their way through the complexities of the political system and to be able to understand the nuances of populism. One tip that you would have.
Wow. yeah, put me on the spot with that one. I think what I'd say is examine things in terms of when you hear a fact or a stat, read the meaning behind it. Look at, you know, if it's an article, what the author, what their vested interest might be. Read more into it, because quite often we read things at face value, and I think that is damaging for us as society, because what we do is we take for given things that people say to us, where actually if we understood more the reasons that they're saying it, we can see, well, actually they're doing it for this reason. And so I think that that's a really important thing, especially in politics, because, you know, more so than a general author, everyone in politics has their own angle they're coming from. I know that I do this in that when I'm writing, I obviously want to emphasise certain aspects and play down certain aspects. And so I think that if you try and navigate the political world, then really investigating who's written it, why they've written, understanding that, I think is a really important aspect.
Okay, so critical analysis of word choice and ulterior motives.
Absolutely.
All right.
Succinctly put.
And final quickfire question I have for you, to borrow from one of the podcast's influences, Desert Island Discs. If you were stranded in this, let's say, I don't know whether it's a utopia or a dystopia, I guess that's for you to decide. But a utopian, dystopian political world, stranded in this desert island, which one luxury item would you have with you to help you deal with the issues and challenges associated with modern day politics?
I guess that the one thing I'd take, and I guess it's a rather abstract notion, is a free and fair press, because I think it's really important to be able to be held to account and to hold whatever government to account. And I think that a really important aspect of that is the press. So I think that in order for a population in this to really examine what the government's doing, it would be a free and fair press.
Wonderful. Well, on that note about press transparency and media voice, I'd like to express my huge gratitude to you, Simon, for all of your friendship, your philosophy, but also your contributions towards the podcast, both before and during today's episode. So thank you very much for everything.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me on. I really enjoyed the whole process, and I think you're doing a fantastic job with the podcast. So keep on doing what you're doing.
Cheers. Well, on that note, because I am now in the process with Chessie, my girlfriend, of moving away from Mexico to Ukraine via England over the summer, there may be a slight hiatus in the next episode of Matt's Musings, but they're certainly in the process of planning. And as with all previous episodes, please do get in touch with your feedback, your constructive criticism, your ideas for future episodes, and any other business. I'm going to leave you with the recently composed outro piece of music by three students from my current school in Mexico, and they are Sebastian, Jimena, and Adriano. Until next time, see you then.